Saudi Arabia is one of the United States' closest allies. It's also one of the most repressive countries in the world. The kingdom's rulers, the Saudi royal family, enjoy absolute power and oversee a sprawling security apparatus that, so far, has been able to suppress a nascent protest movement. Joining us now for today's backstory segment is Madawi al-Rashid, a professor of social anthropology at King's College London and the author of several books, including Contesting the Saudi State and Kingdom Without Borders. Welcome to our show.
Thank you for asking me.
The head of state in Saudi Arabia is King Abdullah. How many other people are part of the House of Saud?
Apparently, there are something like 7,000 princes. Some of them hold key positions, and others have minor roles, and the third group doesn't hold any sort of job. But they all are counted as the Al Saud, and they all receive salaries, monthly salaries from the purse in sort of different degrees. But the Saudi royal family consists of a core of key princes that control obviously, in addition to the king, the crown prince, Ministry of Interior, Ministry of Defense, Foreign Office, and many other key positions, such as, for example, the princes that control the local provinces. Each province of Saudi Arabia has a prince as head of that region.
Well, they obviously are involved in the government, but you say many of the 7,000 are not. Are they a drain on the nation's resources?
Well, obviously, you have a huge group of idle princes receiving huge salaries in addition to other benefits, for example, land distribution schemes, whereby land is given to them and then resold at colossal prices. So the whole system is really corrupt. It's opaque. And it lacks transparency and accountability. Basically, the budget of the country has a special sort of amount of money that nobody knows where it goes, and it is basically for the princes and their personal use.
Is there any other place in the world that is still run as an absolute monarchy where the ruling family considers the state to be personal property?
Well, probably, but not in the same degree, and also in the same at the same scale. Remember, Saudi Arabia is a very, very wealthy country, and it depends on oil rent. And this oil rent comes and to the purse of the king and the other princes, and it is distributed amongst them. And whatever is left, they actually decide how much they should give the population. And the interesting thing about Saudi Arabia is this partnership between the princes and the religious scholars. We have seen throughout the last sort of 8 decades that this relationship is extremely important. The princes rule using multiple strategies. I mentioned the oil rent that is redistributed, but also they rule by promoting a particular interpretation of Islam called Wahhabism. And this religious tradition ensures that the population remains docile. To give you an example, on the 11th of March, the many Saudis on Facebook called for a day of rage. And on that particular day, religious scholars during the Friday sermons preached to the population that if you go on a demonstration, you're actually committing blasphemy. It's a sin. And to demonstrate in a country against the king or ask for your rights in a very, very sort of peaceful way is not acceptable. And they provided religious rulings to prohibit that act of peaceful demonstration. So this is the second strategy that the Al Saud use in order to control the population. And so oil, religion, and finally, the last sort of deadly police state has actually developed its mechanism to control the population. On that day, the 11th of March, we heard reports that the main cities of Saudi Arabia, Riyadh and Jeddah, had incredible presence of a police force that is well equipped, especially during the last 10 years. years under the pretext of fighting terrorism. In fact, the state has enhanced its capacity to control the population, to increase its surveillance. It is basically a police state where nobody can actually say anything. Even people who have posted articles on the internet, on their own personal web pages, they have been taken from their homes and put in prison. And a couple of days ago, people demonstrated in front of the Ministry of Interior asking for political prisoners to be released. And 15 of the demonstrators, including human rights activists, were arrested on the day. People just simply disappear, and nobody knows where they go. And it is up to the princes to release them. So there isn't also an independent judiciary that could look into these cases. People spend years in prison. Nobody knows when they're going to be released. Even when there are sentences passed, they do not actually release them from prison. So it is the whims of the princes that decide what goes on in Saudi Arabia.
It sounds even more repressive than Iran.
It is actually very repressive. Iran has elections. Whether we believe in these elections or not, it does have elections. It does have a change of leadership. We have seen that. There are excesses everywhere. But Saudi Arabia is, in a way, unique in that part of the world. Even if you compare it with other Gulf states like Kuwait, we find that Saudi Arabia lags behind. Saudi Arabia does not allow any kind of civil society to emerge unless it is co-opted by the state. The king announced the establishment of two human rights organizations, and he appoints the director. So these are not independent organizations. They are accountable to the king, and the director is appointed by the king. So in a way, they haven't taken the case of political prisoners. They have not been able to mobilize this population because they are a government agency. So, in a way, what they have done is to co-opt any kind of independent space that can exist between the state and people.
Now, you said earlier there a deal was struck between the Wahhabis and the House of Saud. This is just a deal of convenience, is it? From what I understand, many of the Saudi princes live rather lavish lives, which probably would be not accepted by the Wahhabis. But how is Wahhabism all that different from other Islamic teachings?
Well, the princes are above Wahhabism. Wahhabism is for the ordinary people in the street, in the shopping center, in the cafes and restaurants, in book fairs, where they go and raid these spaces, these urban spaces, in order to discipline the population and often keep them under control. They are basically the spies of the state because their job is to go and investigate what people are doing and then tell them to stop it. And in the process, they report to the state about the local population at the very, very local level, at the level of the street, the neighborhood. Now, in terms of this religious tradition, it evolved since the 18th century. But what has happened is that from the very beginning, it was based on going and telling people, checking what people are doing, and then telling them to stop it.
Aren't there religious morality police, in fact?
Yes, they are. That's just one branch of the Wahhabi institutions that are supported by oil money. The state has incredible institutions that are basically related to Wahhabism, and these institutions are set up not because the princes are pious or they really care about Islam or Muslims. They are set up to achieve that veneer of piety and morality that makes them legitimate, because they remember the Al Saud came to power as a result of annexation of territories in the Arabian Peninsula and as a result of conquest. And therefore, they came by force and they continued to treat the population as a conquered population. And therefore, the Wahhabi Islam, by pretending that they did that in order to spread Islam among people who were regarded as non-Muslim. Although Islam started in Arabia in the 7th century, the Wahhabis and the backers, and their backers, the Al-Saud, regarded the population as blasphemous, as infidels. And this applied to everybody, the Bedouins, the city dwellers, the tribal population, and also the other religious groups, such as the Ismailis and the Shiites. And all those people were regarded as infidels, basically, and they had to be fought in order, under the pretext of bringing them back to true Islam. And in the process, they consolidated the rule of the Al-Saud over the population. So this is a deadly alliance that had crippled the Saudi Arabia over the last 7 decades and didn't allow it to actually engage with political rights, engage with human rights, engage with the debate that is taking place globally about democracy, about human rights, civil rights, gender equality, and all those kinds of issues that have actually affected the Arab world today, and are people are adopting this new language. Saudis are suppressed, and the regime frightens them by saying that if you ask for your political rights, you are going to undermine your security. You are going to have a civil war. We are a tribal society that will disintegrate into chaos. In the last 10 years, they scared the population by using Al-Qaeda as a pretext to suppress any demand for political participation, for democracy, even for some kind of limited power sharing. Today, the biggest issue is sectarian divide. The regime presents itself as a regime that defends the Sunni majority. But I think the Saudi regime has no religion. It only knows power and domination. And it is capable of striking alliances with anybody in order to survive. So today, the regime is scaring Saudis by saying to them that if you go out in the street, you ask for political participation, for increasing human rights, for freedom of speech, you are going to end up overwhelmed by a foreign power, Iran. They use Iran to scare people, and also that translates into increasing suppression of the Shia minority in the eastern province where oil is located.
My guest is Madawi Al-Rashid, a professor of social anthropology at King's College London, author of Contesting the Saudi State and Kingdom Without Borders, among other books. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Well, most of the protesters have been Shia, haven't they? This has been a problem throughout the Middle East where, in some cases, like Iraq, Bahrain, there's a Shiite majority that was pretty much suppressed by a Sunni minority. In the case of Saudi Arabia, the Shiites are definitely a minority, but they sit on the oil, as you say, and they would like to have a little more say in what goes on in the country. They are also victims of Wahhabism because the Wahhabis say that they are really heretics.
Well, the demonstrations that were planned were not particularly Shia. Obviously, the Shia were part of it, but also there were other Sunni groups that called for demonstrations in the heartland of Saudi Arabia, where the Saudi ruling family relies on support. And what actually frightened the regime, not the Shia demonstrations, because the Shia had been demonstrating since the 1940s, and the regime knows that it could suppress them, and the Wahhabi establishment would actually cheer for the act of suppressing them. But what worried the Saudi regime about this recent demonstration was that the calls came from the main heartland of Saudi Arabia, where the Al-Saud sit, and also from different groups. They had the Salafi groups, the Wahhabi groups, who were actually defecting and trying to develop a new discourse that engages with this global democracy talk. And as a result, the regime wanted to portray the demonstrations as a Shia conspiracy against the Sunnis. And they did succeed because they mobilized their intelligence services and they created a sort of a cyber warfare against those who young people who called for demonstrations. And those young people were not predominantly Shia. They were called from Jeddah, which is a Sunni city, from Riyadh, from Qassim, from various parts of Saudi Arabia. But the regime did succeed on the ground by sort of spreading all the security forces and also in cyber warfare against those people who set up Facebook pages and called for demonstrations. Now, to come back to the Shia issue, as I said, the Shia had been demonstrating since the 1940s. They were the workers who worked in the oil field, Aramco. And from that moment, they were calling for their rights for as workers. But again, they were suppressed in the 50s, and they continue to be suppressed. After 1979, with the success of the Iranian Revolution, they felt that they could press for more rights, and they were suppressed, and they call it the uprising of 1979. And they remained in opposition outside Saudi Arabia. I mean, you have some of them in Washington, others are in London, and some are in the Arab world, in Syria and in Iran after 1979. But in 1993, there was a reconciliation between some of the Shia opposition groups and the Saudi government, and they came back hoping that they could actually work together with the government in order to lift some of the discrimination against them in education. You know that there isn't a single minister who's a Shia. There isn't a single ambassador who's a Shia. They're not allowed to join the army or security forces because they are considered as people who have no loyalty to the regime. And they are actually ruled with an iron fist. And they have been asking for their rights, but obviously the government tries to play a game with this minority. It hasn't always been a bad relations. They try to co-opt them sometimes, and sometimes they suppress them. It depends what the majority situation is like. So at the moment, the government is suppressing Shia demonstrations in the eastern province because it wants to please the Wahhabis who supported the government in banning the demonstration and issuing religious opinions against it. So the Saudi regime is like any political acting agency, would try to play the game between the majority and the minority. But to say that they have a specific commitment to Islam or to the Wahhabi tradition is actually not accurate because, as I said, they try to play this game in order to stay in power and in fact, deprive both groups, the Sunni majority and the Shia, of their basic human rights and political rights.
Well, the Saudi government recently sent troops into Bahrain to put down a growing Shiite protest movement there. And some people are suggesting that this is going to develop into a proxy war between Iran and Saudi Arabia.
Absolutely. I mean, you see it on both sides, especially in the media. So far, there are no clashes, no military sort of engagement, but it is happening in the media. And today, I think we live in a media age, you find that the Saudis are launching attacks on Iran and people who are in their own country, for example, the Saudi Shia or the Bahrainis, by describing them as fifth columns, that people who are guided by Iran. And what the Saudi regime has shown is that those Shia, when they go on demonstrations, they take with them pictures of their Iranian religious scholars who happen to be in religious centers in Iran. But this is taken to demonstrate that the Shia have no loyalty to Saudi Arabia. They are loyal to Iran. But this is basically like accusing a Filipino who's a Catholic of having the Pope's picture in their sitting room and accusing them of having no loyalty to the Philippines, but to Rome. It is a ridiculous situation, and it is highly political.
But the Saudi government is claiming that the villains here are Iran and al-Qaeda, which seems to me to be saying everybody's against us.
Well, I think Saudi Arabia has a serious crisis, a serious identity and national identity crisis.
Well, Gaddafi is saying the same sort of thing, that al-Qaeda and Iran are behind his problems as well.
They have used al-Qaeda for a simple reason. They used it to scare the population. In order to keep the population quiet, you have the magnified danger of al-Qaeda. Al-Qaeda did do serious bombing in Saudi Arabia. But to start with, let's ask the question, where did this al-Qaeda come? Didn't al-Qaeda come as a result of the cooperation of the Saudi intelligence services in Afghanistan in the 80s, and then when al-Qaeda became too big, it was striking back at the people who actually supported it and created it to begin with.
Osama bin Laden has gotten a lot of his funding from Saudi Arabia, hasn't he?
Yes, and I remember reading the report that was published in Washington about the financing of al-Qaeda. The episode of al-Qaeda is over, I think, but it is used by the Saudi regime to scare the population. And they wanted to attach al-Qaeda to anybody, but not themselves. So, in a way, they're desperate to find an external danger in order to rally the population around the regime. And this happens throughout history. When governments feel extremely vulnerable, there's nothing like an external enemy that would calm the population down and divert attention. And the Saudis are using Iran today in order to build a national identity. Like, we are Arabs, we are Sunni, Iran is Shia, Iran is Persian, and therefore it is the other that should be despised, that should be fought by all means. And they've already started in the realm, in the media. And the media wars that go on between Saudi Arabia and Iran today is notorious. I've been following television stations that belong to Iran and Saudi Arabia, and you could see how it's enforcing a deep sense of sectarian belonging, dogma, and bias. And the problem with that kind of war, it is resonating with so many people on the ground, and people are responding to these kind of wars. We've seen how demonstrations in Iraq, in Lebanon, in Bahrain, even in Washington, by Bahrainis in front of the Saudi embassy.
Madawi, go ahead.
So this is making the region extremely vulnerable to sectarian wars in the future.
I just wanted to bring up in the few minutes we have left a couple of other areas that might be problematic. According to the Wall Street Journal, the average age of the kingdom's trio of ruling princes is 83, but 60% of Saudis are under the age of 18, so there's probably a large generation gap. I wonder whether women are showing more discontent now, because they are a particularly repressed group in Saudi Arabia, and whether the government's announcement that they may be holding elections in August, on April 23rd, whether that's in response to all of this.
Well, these elections are extremely limited. They've had them in 2005, and they are municipal elections. People, and even then, these councils are half elected, half appointed. All the reports show that they have actually been so inactive. They haven't decided on anything that impacts on people's lives, very much like the appointed consultative council of Saudi Arabia.
What about the generation gap, and what about the gender gap?
The generation gap is serious, and it is a problem. It is a problem because those people who are under the age of 25 are unemployed. The economy has failed to provide jobs, has failed to incorporate this growing young population. Now, women is another issue. We find that 78 of unemployed women have university degrees, whereas only 16% of unemployed men have university degrees, which means that we have a very young women's population that is extremely articulate, educated, with rising aspirations. And these aspirations are not fulfilled. And this is what causes frustration and possibly revolutions among men and women. Because the problem is in Saudi Arabia is there is a high expectation. This is one of the wealthiest countries. Saudis have been educated in the U.S. Apparently today there are 90,000 Saudi students abroad studying college and universities. These people are going to come back, and they are not going to find the job because the economy is simply not generating employment. It is generating consumer consumption, and this is the problem of Saudi Arabia, like possibly other countries. But it is coupled with this high expectation that we Saudis live in one of the wealthiest countries. We can't even own our own house. 70% of Saudis don't own their own house, which is a very, very high percentage in a country that sits on a quarter of oil reserves in the world. So there is this frustration. In addition, there is the problem of the infrastructure. Even a drop of rain in a city like Jeddah causes chaos. And last time it happened, a month ago, 10 people died. So this is basically related to corruption. There are a lot of projects, state development projects, that are announced every other week with huge sums of dollars attached to them. But these development projects have become a way of redistributing the oil wealth among a very limited circle of princes and their entourage. So the population is not getting any tangible benefits from these development projects. To give you one example.
Well, Madawi, I have to leave it there, unfortunately, because we've run out of time. But thank you so much for talking with us. It's been fascinating. Madawi Al-Rashid is a professor of social anthropology at King's College London, author of, among her books, Contesting the Saudi State and Kingdom Without Borders.